From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2016 in Fairfax County, Virginia. It happened on a school playground where teachers heard a group of young white children taunting Hispanic children. The white kids were saying, "If Trump is elected president, you won't live here anymore." And the executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse says, "We need to understand our children are watching. Our children are listening." In schools across the country, we're hearing from administrators who are concerned that students feel more brazen about insulting one another. And the Institute for Civil Discourse has concluded that incivility has become the norm, not the exception, in modern American politics. Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer recently said that the 2016 presidential campaign has actually legitimated that it's okay to be uncivil in your speech. So can we change it? RIT's Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty is hosting its fifth annual symposium, and they have invited Dr. Lukensmeyer, who is the executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, to give a presentation. It's happening this evening. It's entitled "Incivility and Political Dysfunction: What Can We Do About It?" She's here first on Connections, helping perhaps guide a way towards that. And it's great to have you, Dr. Lukensmeyer. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you, Evan. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I'm first of all wondering if you really think this is a unique time in American history, or based on your best estimation, is this a unique time in terms of incivility?
Actually, we decided to do a survey of political historians in the country to ask whether or not this was a unique pattern or whether this is something typical or that we've seen it many times before. And partly we did that because a lot of people push back and say, well, politics has always been a food fight.
Sure.
Politics has always been tough. Well, what the political historians say from the whole ideological perspective, whether they're in their leanings right or left or center, the only other time in American history that it has gotten this uncivil and this otherizing and marginalizing of groups of people was post-Reconstruction when Jim Crow came back in after the Civil War. Now, there's clearly been tough issues in politics all the time. We had times when a member of the House hit another member with a cane, when a gun was shot in the House, way back historically. But in modern political history, what we're witnessing right now is something we have not seen since the Civil War.
And so I want to make clear to our listeners, our guest has some experience in the political realm as an advisor to the chief of staff at the White House in the 1990s and as chief of staff for Ohio Governor Dick Celeste back in the late 80s, early 90s, right?
So yes. You've
been in the political arena and you've seen some incivility.
Of course.
So for our listeners who think, well, you know, this is we can't be fragile in politics. Politics is always rough. Politics ain't beanbag, as they say. What did you see both at that state level and then at the national level?
What's really changed is, although it's always been rough and tumble, there was a commitment to figuring out how to compromise on the big issues that the members of the state of Ohio's legislature knew their constituents wanted from them. So yes, there were times when they really battled, there were issues they were never going to agree on, but it was understood that our role, our responsibility as representatives, is to figure out compromises on the biggest, toughest issues. Now, for a whole series of structural issues, too much money in politics, gerrymandering, primaries that only about 20% of the people vote in, these are structural reasons that have brought us to the place that, I'll take the United States Congress. There's no overlap between the most conservative Democrat, the most liberal Republican. In modern political history, this is the first time that's ever happened. So they're like two bipolar groups who really have no incentives to actually come together. Unfortunately, media, particularly social media and broadcast media, often actually incentivize people to say the most outrageous things because they know they'll get on the 6 o'clock news. They know they'll be interviewed about it. So there are lots of structural reasons that have made this period completely different than 40 years ago.
Is what you're doing in part a call for centrism?
That's a good question. I've never been asked it that way before. What immediately comes to mind is, actually, de Tocqueville said this about Americans in 1837, and Pew probably does the most consistent polling that shows this, that Americans in writ large actually do move to the center on almost all issues, other than about 10 to 11% on the right and about 7 to 9% on the left currently. So in an interesting way, if we were asking our representatives to be who the people are, it would be a request to move to the center.
All right, listeners, as we talk about incivility in politics, I'm going to want to hear your stories as we go throughout the hour, because what the work of this organization attempts to touch is, yes, the halls of power, but also the way that trickles down. I mentioned at the top of the hour, and we'll talk more about this. Our kids are watching. Our kids are listening. It impacts neighborhoods. I've said on this program before, I'll give you the stat again. In 1976, Jimmy Carter wins the presidency. 27% of American counties were so-called landslide counties, in which the presidential winner was 20 points or more ahead in that particular county. So 27% of landslide counties in 1976, and you go ahead 40 years, 2016, and it's more than 60%. We are truly moving away from people who disagree with us. And it is truly uncomfortable for people to be around people who might have different opinions. And so there's a lot that we can talk about here. And we'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me get this out of the way, though, because what I'm going to read is one of the defenses of incivility. And, you know, Dr. Lukensmeyer has heard this in many different forms. I chose the Hoover Institution's Bruce Thornton, who wrote a long piece saying that incivility is a good thing. And let me just excerpt from that. Quote, rather than reflecting some recent decline in political decorum, the incivility that many comments lament is as old as the ideological conflicts that have defined democracy since its origins in ancient Athens. A dislike of political rancor is at heart a dislike of democracy and a misunderstanding of the constitutional structure and its purpose. Starting in ancient Athens, democracy has given the vote and equal participation in policy deliberation to citizens regardless of wealth, status, or knowledge. Given the wide variety of conflicting interests, ideologies, and character among the citizenry, the public deliberation that lies at the heart of democracy policymaking has always been rough, vulgar, even insulting, often at a level far beyond what we today call the politics of personal destruction. As Craig Shirley, biographer of Ronald Reagan, said recently, the last thing we need in American politics is more civility. Civility is often the camouflage for hiding challenges to the big government faction and concealing the collusion of bipartisan elites that has created the redistributionist entitlement state. After all, the First Amendment does not protect merely decorous or genteel speech, but as the political rhetoric of American history shows, all manner of speech, no matter how rude or uncivil. That's because our political ancestors knew something we should never forget, that as the Athenian Sophocles said, free men have free tongues. End quote.
Well, it's interesting. What I would say is both men are really accurate that our founders built into our Constitution conflicts that we still feel deeply today. Federalism, the issue, where does the power? Nationally or in the states. The issue of should our economy be basically manufacturing or agriculture? We have a new version of that. So yes, democracy was intended to be conflictual. But it also, and if you read those founders, James Wilson is the one that comes to mind. They really spoke about it's essentially a conversation, and it's the quality of the conversation that is what matters. And we've come to a place where the quality of the conversation is not leading to resolution and compromise. I think with both of those quotes, we could go to some of those times of rancor, but actual decisions really got made.
Sure.
The Civil War being the best example. Now, I'm very surprised, Craig Shirley, who was your second author, I just moderated a panel with Craig at the Tucson Book Festival no more than 10 days ago. And in that context, Craig said publicly, your listeners could watch it on C-SPAN, that incivility had gotten to the point that the Congress was no longer able to do the job Americans sent them to do.
How interesting. So he used to defend incivility as just a hallmark of democracy, but even he is now seeing.
And frankly, he offered to really get involved with the Institute and particularly to bring some of the most conservative right side of the ideological spectrum into this conversation more actively than they are today.
And this is where I would also like to ask Bruce Thornton of the Hoover Institution, who I'm just quoting from there, where I think he goes sort of intellectually lazy is this idea that, well, free men have free tongues. no one is saying, at least I don't think your organization is saying, that it should be illegal to be uncivil,
or definitely not,
or that we should restrict speech in a way that leads to more censorship.
Definitely not.
It's a conversation about whether our behavior is improvable. That if we can get better, not by law or by fiat from government. So this notion of, well, free men have free tongues, so get used to it, is lazy, I think.
And what I would think would be really interesting would be for Bruce to have a conversation with Stephen Carter, who wrote the book Civility in 1996. And he actually references exactly the same history, the agoras in Athens, the early years in this country, and comes to a completely different conclusion. Never the intention to stop the conflict, never the intention to interrupt free speech. But in our country, we have been progressively moving towards social norms of civility and respect as part of the fabric of not just how political candidates and representatives treat each other, but how we treat each other in our neighborhoods, in our churches. Frankly, the Institute, beginning early in the 2016 election, we began to get thousands of messages, social media, email, red states, blue states, purple states, with Americans really upset about the degraded language in that presidential election. We actually were asked by the Commission on Presidential Elections to do a set of standards for the general election debates. We had a graduate student look at every single presidential debate back to 60 with Nixon and Kennedy. And if you just went back to the two Obama races, one against John McCain and one against Mitt Romney, and then think of the language that was used in this last election, nothing tougher than something like, well, he just told a whopper, but wouldn't come anywhere near to saying, you're a liar. So that transition is in the last 4 years.
We're talking to Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who is the executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Nonpartisan organization?
Totally nonpartisan.
And she's the keynote speaker tonight for RIT's Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty's 5th Annual Symposium. The event is free and open to the public. It is at 7:30 tonight at RIT's Ingle Auditorium, titled Incivility and Political Dysfunction, What Can We Do About It? So if you want to go out tonight, 7:30 tonight, free and open to the public. Our first phone call comes from Andrew in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, doctor. I hope you're successful in your endeavors here.
Thank you, Andrew.
Sometimes Evan has this wonderful man on, David Johnston.
David K. Johnston.
Yeah, he writes great books, and he's a very smart guy. And he said, and Evan will recall this probably, that he thinks that if Democrats want to start winning elections again, they need to stop calling Republicans racists. And I was wondering what you thought of that.
Andrew, thanks for the phone call. Just to clarify, if I recall correctly, I think what David Kaye is saying is I don't want to speak for David Kaye. I'm going to try to remember. I think the idea is if Democrats say, well, if you voted for Trump, you're a racist, that is not productive to moving the conversation forward, and it leads to more tribalism and more separation of neighborhoods, ideas, et cetera, and that gets sort of out of the pale. What do you think?
Andrew, I think it's a great point, and I completely agree. Whether it's an example of a Democrat calling a Republican racist, or whether it's an example of a Republican calling a Democrat something relative to the allowing too many immigrants into the country would be a good example. Neither of those do anything to move either the Congress or the public toward a capacity to really deal with very tough issues in our culture. Literally, how do we absorb the newest wave of immigrants? Literally, how do we deal with the structural racism that still exists in our country that's totally visible in the economy and totally visible in the issues of public safety? So you're absolutely right, Andrew. It helps nothing.
844-295-TALK. And listeners, what I want to hear from you is, do you see political incivility affecting your neighborhood, your children, the schools your kids go to, your family relationships? What do you expect from your political leaders? And who do you think is really doing it well? Is there anybody who is sort of setting a good standard when it comes to political civility? That is not, by the way, I don't want to get too bogged down in this idea that there can't be disagreement or conflict. That is not at all what our guest is saying. But we're talking about the difference between sort of productive conflict and perhaps compromise versus incivility and just rancor outright, sort of dominating conversations. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Are there good examples on the political scene right now that you say, this is somebody who is really doing it well?
Actually, I'll go national first.
Yep.
A great example in the United States Senate is Lamar Alexander, a longtime Republican from Tennessee, and Patty Murray, a longtime Democrat from Washington, in the context in which almost no legislation has passed in the Senate on any of the toughest issues. They've managed to move two bills through the Senate on education in the last two sessions. In recent times, in the current administration, there have been bipartisan groups that really worked to get the DACA deal finished inside the tax reform deal. Now, it failed in the end, but there were about 12 members from both parties who spent days really working on that. In the House of Representatives, a number of people have joined something called the Honor and Civility Caucus, led by a guy named Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, and Charlie Crist, a Democrat from Florida. And they now have had 125 members sign a very strong commitment to civility. So they've taken the first step. They actually, it's a tough statement. In the first paragraph, they say that political vitriol has actually led to Americans' reduced trust in government, and it's their responsibility to do something about it. Now, that caucus is still too new. They don't have a track record yet, like Murray and that I mentioned before in terms of passing legislation. But your callers should look up your own members, their own district members. If they've signed this statement and have joined this caucus, they should send a note of praise. They should say, thank you, this is the direction we need to go. And if they haven't yet joined, they should send a note, please join this caucus.
How much damage is this White House doing to political civility?
I have to take a deep breath, and this one is the toughest from our belief completely in being nonpartisan. For people who are listening who may be deep Trump believers and supporters, it's very difficult for them not to hear this as an attack on the president. This is just a statement of fact. The president does use language that actually otherizes different groups of people. And the president does use language that any teacher in an elementary school in this country can tell you has literally led to children who in some cases don't even really understand the concept, like the quote you used at the top of the hour. It's also true that we are seeing at the high school and college level more aggressive, divisive behavior than has typically been the case. People who hold powerful positions, whether they're in politics or business or religion, they are the models that people look to. And unfortunately, this president legitimates the use of aggressive, disrespectful language in a way that we haven't seen a president do in modern history.
And to be clear to our listeners again, because listeners have heard me on this program for the last 3+ years talking about the man who's now the president, it put a lot of people in a hard position because I don't think objectivity is achievable. I think all human beings have biases. I think it's important to be self-aware of biases, especially if you're a journalist. But I have not been shy about saying this is someone who is clearly uninterested in civility, is rude to a point of superfluousness routinely. And I've seen my own son sort of recoil at some of the language that is used in a way that you would never have seen from I'm going to sound like just sort of this both sides are, but no Republican. And this is not about Republicans and Democrats. Mitt Romney is just probably about the most civil person you could probably meet. And again, I know I'm going to get emails about that, but I'm making the point just about basic decorum. And this president doesn't have it.
Absolutely. And I think where people who don't seem to be impacted by Trump's language are people like most Americans who were just sick of political correctness.
That's right.
But it's possible to leave political correctness behind without going to a level of insulting the dignity of other human beings.
Let me get a couple more phone calls. Let me grab a couple who have been waiting. Joy in Rochester. Go ahead, Joy.
Hi. I'm just enjoying your show, and I think one of the challenges with the decline in civil discourse on a federal level is that it's normalized the decline of civil discourse on a personal level. And within the American Jewish community, there's been a lot of discussion over the past couple of years about the impact of that decline on civil discourse related to Israel. That the way American Jews talk about and to each other about their difference of opinions, whether it's related to Israeli policy or various things, has really created deep, deep rifts in the American Jewish community that we haven't seen in decades. And the local Rochester Jewish Federation recently sponsored a program with a national organization in partnership with the Lewis S. Wolk JCC specifically on that topic to bring people together locally to say, how do we as a community talk about our disagreements in ways that are civil and that further the conversation and create the type of community in which we all want to live.
Joy, I'm really glad that you have shared this perspective because it gives me the opportunity to say something very important in terms of the Institute Now's major effort with the public is to revive civility and respect in conversation and in conflict. And we've actually worked with rabbis from all over the country. We've worked from ministers from all over the country. We've worked with some imams all over the country. The biggest surprise to us, frankly, at our organization, we've actually received calls from executives in major U.S. corporations asking if we have tools and any guidance to how to bring people together back from the trust that's been lost because of who they voted for in the presidential election. And what they tell us is that their concern is their product innovation teams. And Joy, I'm sure you know, like everyone listening, for major corporations, their product innovation teams are their bottom line 5 to 10 years from now. So these are professional engineers. These are professional people who've worked together for years to create new products, who somehow, whatever that chasm is between how did my life experience bring me to vote for this candidate and your life experience brought you to vote for that candidate, I just don't trust you anymore. And in the example you give about Israel, not only has the conversation and conflict gotten really serious in many communities, but the Southern Poverty Law Center, who is the premier organization in the country for keeping the records on hate crimes, actually have tracked that anti-Semitic acts have gone up during this period of time, not quite as dramatically as anti-Muslim behavior, but it's a, you know, violent words do change to move to violent behavior. So this is a very high concern, and I'm delighted to hear that your community has come together to actually take steps to repair this fracture.
I just got back from 10 days in Spain, and I want to ask you about something that someone in Madrid, a comment made by a resident of Madrid that has stayed with me. If you go throughout Spain, what you see, which is new, is Spanish flags hanging from apartment flats everywhere. I mean, all over the place. And what it actually means is anti-Catalunya, because Catalunya and Eastern Province has been moving towards secession, independence, and the Spanish national government has tried to squash that. So Catalunya has almost daily demonstrations. And as a essentially as a province itself, it's still somewhat split, but there's a lot of growing sentiment toward independence. So if you go to Catalonia, there's Catalonian flags everywhere, which is essentially a way of saying anti-Spain, pro-independence. And so I was talking to someone in Madrid, and he said, look, he said, when government can convince people that they should turn against someone who's not quite like them, they can then have a shield for being corrupt, for being uncivil, for doing things that are not in the interest of the people, as long as they can say, well, we're on your side because we're against these people. And for right now in Spain, it's Spain against Catalonia. And he said, look, I live in Madrid. This is the worst government I've seen in my lifetime. They're corrupt. They're doing terrible things. But a lot of my friends say, well, they're on our side against those darn Catalonians. So we're going to be with them. We're going to allow this corruption because they're going to sort of drum up fervor against the other. Same thing in Catalonia. You heard people saying, we're not a big fan of Catalonian parliament, but hey, they're against the rest of Spain and Madrid, so we can excuse that. And I wonder, is that, you think that's part of the human DNA, that when things aren't great, if we can create a scapegoat of the other, that number one, it makes us feel better about ourselves, and number two, we will excuse corruption in our leaders who will drum that up in us?
Well, there isn't any question you could go all throughout human history. It does seem to be somehow in the human species that we need to feel superior to some other group. And in the best times in world history, we have leaders and we have people who are moving toward the better angels, to quote Lincoln, to not really reify those kinds of feelings and make it legitimate to put an other down to feel better about myself. If we bring it back to home, how that's happening in the United States today is with immigrants. And the irony of that one is this entire nation is a country of an immigrant. Maybe some of our families go back several generations, but there's no one here who didn't originally come from someplace else other than Native Americans, who we also still dominantly otherize. But I want to take a minute, if I can, Evan, particularly because of Joy's call, I'm reminded. Mm-hmm. Because we've had so many requests from people all over the country, we've put a lot of creative energy into creating tools, discussion guides for people to actually do this in their own communities. It might be a Rotary Club, it might be at work. If you go to www.revivecivility.org, you'll find a whole set of tools that you can download. And we do webinars. For example, the example that Joy gave, we've done this in several communities where a congregation really wants some help about how to facilitate a 100-person meeting where they really have to deal with a conflict. So we do a webinar which trains their own team to actually take the materials and utilize them in their synagogue. Another thing that we actually discovered a few years ago working on the issue of mental health challenges to young people after the Newtown slaughter of children is we thought about young people. Where do they all hang out? On their devices. What do they mostly do? They text. So we've created a software platform called Text Talk Civility. That's the focus right now is civility. And we're having a national week of conversation, April 20th to the 28th. And if you go to the website, www.revivecivility.org, you can find discussion guides, you can find this texting platform. In fact, your listeners right now could pick up your cell phone, just text 89800. Type civility in the message line. It will take you to a back-end computer that has a script that walks you through how to actually have a conversation with someone who holds a very different view than you do. You're not going to try to change each other's mind. You're actually going to get some skills to learn to listen again purely for understanding. Why did my life experience bring me to the place where I want a wall and I want the army to be on that border? And your life experience brought you to a place where you don't want a wall and you don't want the U.S. Army on your border. So that's the kind of issue that people are really caught up in these days. We haven't come to an understanding of what the solutions are, but we aren't even actually talking about meaningful solutions in our communities in many cases, and certainly not in our politics. So we hope you'll join the National Week of Conversation. Talk with someone who has a different idea than you do. Send us a quick video after the conversation and tell us how it went.
Revivecivility.org. That's the website.
Absolutely.
Revivecivility.org. David in Pittsford, I'm coming to you in 1 second just to close this point here. I have come to think that in conversations with people who disagree vehemently, and sometimes with people who have views that I can't even get my head around, I think the most productive thing I can do is not spend this conversation trying to change their mind necessarily, but trying to at least say that we are going to leave this conversation. And if you ask me, hey, Joe thinks this, and you think something different, tell me why Joe believes that. Or tell me what he actually believes. Can I articulate it in a way that Joe would say, yes, that's right. As opposed to, can I do it without caricaturing him and making him seem in the same way that I would then hope that he would say, Evan believes this. And I would say, okay, I know you don't agree with me, but you are accurately representing my views. Thank you for doing that. As opposed to caricaturing. That to me is a good first step.
You're right in the same territory that we're describing, because in order to do that, you have to be able to listen dropping your own biases sufficiently to actually understand why that person thinks like they think. And in our experience, when that moment happens, it is a different experience between the two people. There is more respect. There is more capacity at some other point, potentially, to continue the conversation. I want to say one other thing. Like most other areas of life, there are people on many of the issues that we're talking about, even about who you voted for, that are so extreme. They're so far out. Don't pick that person to try this with. It 9 times out of 10 isn't going to work. But pick some relationship you care about that has been fractured and start there.
David in Pittsburgh, next on the phone. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, when I was in high school, one of the extracurricular activities they offered was a debating club. And sometimes they were assigned topics. Sometimes the debates were about real life differences of opinion. But at other times, the debates were about nonsensical positions, which where the idea was to learn how to structure a debate and use logic based on these nonsensical positions. My one big criticism was that it was only offered as an extracurricular activity, and I think that it would be beneficial if everyone in high school had to take part in a debating club with Robert's Rules of Orders and so on. That's it.
Your point is very well taken, and you may already know this, but you know, the whole country has been really woken up by the students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School after the Parkland shooting. And many people who wanted to attack them accused them of somehow having been given notes from somebody. Well, what's most interesting, I think, of because of your comments, sir, is that entire public school system introduces debate beginning in elementary school. Elementary school students begin to learn how to do arguments. They also do it in junior high school. They do it in high school. So you're watching young people who have had the opportunity to learn to think not only about their own natural position, but about positions that are completely opposite of them, and to be articulate in both positions. So you're right. It should be required or offered for everyone rather than just being something you do after school.
My guest is Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, the Executive Director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. She's giving a keynote address tonight at RIT's Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. It's part of their 5th annual symposium. Tonight, 7:30 at RIT's Ingle Auditorium, it is free and open to the public, titled Incivility and Political Dysfunction, What Can We Do About It? So that's tonight at 7:30. When we come back from our only break of the hour, I'm going to ask her, what would a truly civil American political system look and sound like? And so-called negative ads. You know, don't we need to be able to point out where our opponents have gone wrong? Can we really take away negative ads? Is that too Pollyanna or idealistic? Where do we draw the line? So there's a lot to talk about here with Dr. Lukensmeyer, and we're going to do that after our only break of the hour. First, I've got to tell you what's coming up Thursday on the next Connections. We talk about the future of transit, and we'll see if there's a carless future for us. Some say cars are on the way out. They're not environmentally friendly. They're not economical. Others say that that's a ways away. We are not connected enough as communities to rely on bikes or public transit. So we're going to talk to people who have made the switch away from cars to bicycles, even here in Rochester, and people who've switched back from bikes to cars, about how transit works for them. That's all tomorrow on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is our guest here, who's about to tell us what it would really look and sound like if we had a civil political system.
Evan, we think this is so important. We have just put together what we're calling a brain trust that has former members of Congress on it from the U.S. Senate, like Tom Daschle, Olympia Snowe, that has members of state legislatures who are currently in office, that has journalists from print, from broadcast, from the internet. And I'm thinking today we didn't have a radio person in it, and we should get them in it. We may call on you. But we've asked that brain trust to actually do two things with us. And I mean, this is uncanny how close this is. One is, we know when you're trying to work towards something different, you do need an actual description of what would civil politics look like. And I'll come back to it and say some of the beginning conversation. But the second thing we're looking at is it possible to create incentives to reduce negative campaigning? And that one's really tough because the data shows that negative campaigning works.
But what's negative campaigning? How do we define that?
Good question. And the way you introduced it, I would say there's two categories of negative campaigning, one of which we would see as acceptable and one of which we would see as unacceptable in civil politics. If we're running against each other and you've got a voting record that I know doesn't resonate with constituents that we're both after their votes, that's a negative ad. I'm going to run, you did X, Y, and Z, and I believe the constituents. But that's a fact. You actually did that.
Yeah.
The kind of negative campaigning was, and, you know, let's just think again back to the presidential, Crooked Hillary, Little Marco. I mean, just tons and tons of examples of no content whatsoever other than attack on the person. And we've actually also been talking to some political consultants, and they mirror what the public tells us. They're very worried that 2018 will be uglier than 2016. And consultants say, we saw what worked in 2016. It probably will be uglier than 2018 probably will be uglier. So back to your original question. Mm-hmm. What would a civil politics look like? A civil politics would try to stay in the legitimate use of data that fits your actual, what you actually did. And I can rate you as negative on your behavior rather than trying to attack you on your character. A civil politics would respect that we have an ideological spectrum about beliefs on issues because we really have those differences. But to move the society forward in a current time frame, compromise is the essence of politics. That's even something that people who are supporting incivility would say, compromise is a dirty word. So a civil politics would respect what has always been treated as core, which is our differences have to come to a point of decision, which seems to represent the most common good, the most inclusive decision at this moment in time. Maybe that will shift later. So the principles would be no character assassination, a belief that we really have to have enough relationships across the aisle that we can solve problems together that are really negatively impacting the American economy, the American public. You know, part of what I'll talk about tonight, our Congress hasn't worked the way Congress was intended to work in almost two decades. Regular order, which is the process by which budgets are passed, has not operated for more than a decade. Most Americans don't even actually understand this. We have not had a formal U.S. budget for the next year for 13 or 14 years, which means Congress and federal agencies are all wrapped up in what they call continuing resolutions. Managers in agencies have to redo a budget every 4 or every 6 weeks. Imagine the human capacity that eats up. So a civil politics would hold the target that our job is to represent the American public, to solve the most incredible issues facing the nation. Sometimes we'll win on our side, sometimes we'll lose on our side, but we would not take the position that all we care about is ensuring that you lose. And that's how it's operating today.
Now, I can't help but think of a conversation we had yesterday on this program. The director of a new film that's coming out nationally on Friday called Chappaquiddick. And for years, Republicans, when Ted Kennedy would run for re-election in the Senate or float the idea of a presidential campaign, Republicans would say Chappaquiddick, Chappaquiddick. And I do not want to speak monolithically because we heard from a variety of opinions from the political left yesterday, but some Democrats would say that's just character assassination. That's not fair. That's not Ted Kennedy's governing record, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't go to jail. Well, number one, the movies reminded us that most people would have gone to jail if they weren't a senator and that he probably should have gone to jail. But he didn't go to jail. And so is it legitimate for his opponents to say in future years, look what happened here. I know it's not related to his governing, but I'm sorry. Or is Chappaquiddick out of bounds?
Well, it's very interesting, that example, because part of the way it was used really early on probably was out of bounds. But the bottom line is, Ted Kennedy, to his credit, and not to his credit the choices he made around Chappaquiddick, but to his credit after that, he chose to become one of the best senators working in a bipartisan way in the United States Senate. So in his later campaigns, that didn't come up again in any serious way, or someone might have tried it, but his record overtook the scandal around Chappaquiddick. The way it's working today, and it's part a lot because of 24/7 media, a lot because of social media, if that same thing were to happen to another person today, they would not make it through, even if they were somehow related to one of the iconic families in the United States. So the particular both unfortunate choices that Ted Kennedy made at the time, but the following choices that he made and had ended up with a stellar career, if that were to happen to someone today, they wouldn't have a chance.
Here's Herman writing, saying, can you please talk about the role that talk radio and connections in 1A accepted play in fomenting incivility, demonization, and polarization? He's talking about talk radio that is host-driven, not guest and issue-driven, as this program is. You know, one host sort of talking at listeners as opposed to engaging with subjects. He's saying that leads to a lot of incivility, a lot of anger, a lot of fiery emotion, etc. How do you feel about that?
There's no question, but what talk radio and frankly broadcast television in the same time frame, remember the Crossfire program that there was finally so much public response to that they took it off the air? It's become the coin of the realm in terms of talk radio for many people that are where it's ideologically driven. They are not listening. They don't care about the policy. Their only goal is to incite their listeners to really hold these very high emotions about particular people and particular issues. What's really incredible about it to me, and many of those talk radio hosts will actually acknowledge off-air that they don't even personally hold the views that they're screaming about on air, but they have a business model that works for them and they have no intention of letting it go. So yes, that kind of talk radio, clearly some of the ideologically driven current broadcast stations have the same problem. And it's even worse than the internet in terms of particular voices that choose to take it as far as they can take it.
Your organization starts at what level of government? Who have been the takers who say, yes, we'd like to be more civil? What are the results that you've seen?
It's a great question. Thank you. You know, we didn't mention, but our origin story, we were created at the University of Arizona 10 days after the memorial for the people who died in the Tucson mass shooting when Gabby Giffords, a member of the House of Representatives, was severely wounded with a brain injury. And the challenge to us was, make something good come out of this. So we began to work completely in the House of Representatives because she'd been a member for several terms. She was highly respected for her bipartisanship. She understood you have to have a relationship with people to work with them. She was one of the women that started the women's softball team in the House. So we started working in the House of Representatives. And frankly, the knees were cut out from under us by the then majority leader in the House named Eric Cantor, whose then constituents cut his knees off not too long after that. But we shifted our focus to working in states. And we did it because a Republican senator in Iowa and a Democratic member of the House from Ohio, both important swing states in this country, came to us and said, big PAC money is now coming into our states trying to create the same kind of hyperpartisanship and dysfunction here in the state legislature as is already been dominating Washington. So we watched their idea, which was a workshop called Building Trust Through Civil Discourse, where they brought members from both parties together to actually learn to see one another, not through their filters of Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative, but back again as human beings. We've now taken that workshop into 16 states in the United States. More than 800 state legislators have participated in it. We have a national network of state legislators committed to civil governance. One of the stars of this work is a current Republican member of the Senate in Ohio who's now running for Secretary of State. He's actually proposed to his Democratic opponent that the two of them come out and announce, let's run a civil campaign. We both believe in the same things. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I'm being concrete to say this is working extremely well at the state legislature level. We are now getting requests from mayors and city councilors. So we have signed a memorandum of understanding with an organization called Mayors for Innovation so that we can actually bring our tools to the staff members of that organization. We're just not large enough to do this in cities all over the country. So we will do it in a few cities to demonstrate how it works, and then this organization will take it and disperse it across the country. So we see great hope in the lower levels of government, so to speak, local and state. The incentives and the structures at the national level are still set up to kill this kind of behavior when you get to the Senate or the House. But our belief is that when the critical mass of members come in already committed to these practices and principles, they've seen it work in their states, eventually a critical mass is going to shift, just like the critical mass of the Tea Party in 2010 and 2012 put a real stranglehold on what Republican leadership could make happen in the House.
Got a few more minutes, so I'd love for you to tell me why you think ranked choice voting could help with this. Our listeners have been asking about this on different days and different occasions and might have heard mention of this. So let's talk a little bit more in case you've missed some of the discussion about ranked choice voting. Why, what it is, how it works, and why it could actually impact civility.
Well, we are actually very strong on ranked choice voting, and we're very strong on it specifically because it decreases incivility and increases civility. How it works is when you vote, you don't just vote for one person, you vote for a couple of people, depending on how that particular race is operating. And then if no one gets more than 50% of the vote, there's a runoff between the top two candidates. So that means the candidate's incentives are not to be so terribly attacking of another candidate because that might be the person they end up in a runoff with. And they might be, you want that person's voters to choose you as their second rank, even if they're not going to choose you first. So by definition, it's a structure that encourages non-character assassination, encourage civil respect of each other. Maine passed this. The most recent state to pass this is Maine. They did it as a referendum in the past election, and high public support. Interesting dynamic to watch because certain members of the Maine legislature then tried to undo ranked choice voting because they saw it being more difficult for them to hold power. So now there's a real issue in Maine between the elected officials who don't want it, the public who does want it, and those of your listeners who are interested should watch how that works out this year.
The keynote speaker for RIT's Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty's 5th Annual Symposium is my guest for this hour. A few more minutes with Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who's the Executive Director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. And the event tonight is free. It's open to the public at 7:30 p.m. tonight. RIT's Ingle Auditorium, Incivility and Political Dysfunction. What can we do about it? When you speak at events like this, what are the most common questions you get? What are the most common either complaints or ideas you're hearing from people?
Great question. There are still people who are asking, isn't civility just asking people to be nice to each other? That comes up fairly frequently. I actually do a lot of audience participation when I'm speaking, which is another reason I hope your listeners will come, because they actually can experience some of the tools that we're using with people. So when I get that question, I often turn it into an experience between audience members. Another question that's often asked is, given how many of the incentives in our politics and in our campaigning support incivility, isn't this an uphill battle? And I acknowledge, yes, this is an uphill battle. But the bottom line is, this has become like a virus that's infected our families and our neighborhoods and our faith places of worship and our businesses. So we're at a point where if we as the people don't figure out how to both really be more civil with each other again and demand from our elected officials that they also shift, there's nothing left to incentivize them, because the structures are all the other direction. So it's right back to we the people. We really have to take a stand on this.
Politics, more than anything, responds to markets. And the market of ideas will win on this if this looks like you can win elections being civil. Right now, it's a challenge to convince people you can win elections with a platform of civility. It doesn't mean a platform of never saying anything negative about your opponent, but how are you going to convince people that this wins?
Well, you'll be very interested in this. The National Network of State Legislators I mentioned a moment ago, when we asked them what the next level of training that they actually wanted to our help with, far and away, the highest choice was how to run a positive campaign and win. So what we've now done is pulled together some people who have done that successfully, both Republicans and Democrats in various states around the country, and brought them together with their political consultants to actually tell the stories to other state legislators about how did they do it and why did they win.
I love that idea. And let people know where to find you online. What website should they be using?
www.revivecivility.org for all of our tools about how to do this yourself. And our organizational website, nicd.arizona.edu, where you can learn about our state legislative work as well as the Revive Civility work.
ReviveCivility.org. And listeners, I can tell you that having spoken privately to a number of administrators, superintendents, school superintendents, there is a lot of concern that kids are watching and listening and taking their cues from the top. And they are hearing more aggressive, insulting behavior in schools. We're going to have a separate conversation going forward about that. I promise you, some of it is just getting people comfortable enough to talk about it. It's tough. But I really want to thank our guests, and you can see Dr. Carolyn Lukensmeyer tonight. That is at 7:30 at Engel Auditorium at RIT for Incivility and Political Dysfunction. What can we do about it? Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Evan. It was great.
And I think there's a lot that we all can learn. By the way, me included, we've all had those weak moments. So our thanks to Dr. Lukensmeyer and RIT for providing this conversation. Rob Braden, who's the engineer, who's usually pretty civil. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to provoke him. Megan Mack is the producer, always civil. I'm Evan Dawson. I can do much better. And we're all going to try tomorrow on member-supported public radio.